1 Corinthians chapter 3. And we're going to start at verse 13. First Corinthians 3:13. Paul is your author. And Paul writes, "Each one's work will become manifest, for the day will disclose it, because it will be revealed by fire, and the fire will test what sort of work each one has done. If the work that anyone has built on the foundation survives, he will receive a reward. If anyone's work is burned up, he will suffer loss, though he himself will be saved, but only as through fire. Do you not know that you are God's temple, and that God's Spirit dwells in you? If anyone destroys God's temple, God will destroy him. For God's temple is holy, and you are that temple." Verse 16, "Do you not know that you are God's temple, and that God's Spirit dwells in you? If anyone destroys God's temple, God will destroy him. For God's temple is holy, and you are that temple." May the Lord add a blessing to the reading, hearing, and living of his word. So this past Tuesday, my wife goes to school to pick our children up from school. And my children are in preschool. My daughter is 4 and my son is 3. And when she gets to my son's class to pick him up, the teacher pulls her aside because she has to have a one-on-one conversation with her regarding something that happened that day at school. It turns out that my son hit a little girl in the classroom. He hit this little girl in the class. And she tells her what the deals of it. The teacher's not extremely concerned about it. She says it was more a matter of him swinging his hands and letting them know, "Don't get too close to me." And they didn't honor the warnings. And when they got too close, he hit them. Okay? And so she wasn't super concerned about it, but she did want for us to have a conversation with him to let him know that it is not okay for him to hit people in the classroom. So I don't know about this. I'm having a long, hard day at work, and then I come home, and then Cherie tells me Ellis hit someone at school, and the teacher's not super concerned about it, but she wants for us to have a conversation with him about hitting. She wants us to have this conversation with him. So I sit down with him, and I have questions for him, and one of the questions is, What took over you that made you think it was okay for you to hit this little girl? Because you need to understand this about me. No boy who I raise will readily put his hands on a woman. It's a thing for me. And so, and the teacher saying, telling me it's not that big a deal because he's only 3. I said, yes, but the men who put their hands on women at 23 were doing it at 3. So daddy needs to come along and make it very clear to him that this is not okay. So I'm having a conversation with him, and I'm walking him through this, and I'm understanding something, and that is, he's looking at me thinking, "Dad, I'm 3, and you're expecting me to rationalize this thing out. She got on my nerves, so I put my hands on her." That's how his mind works. Then in the middle of the conversation, he brings something to my attention that I did not know. Here's what you need to know for historical cultural context. A month ago, a student in the classroom bit him on his back. To this day, he still has the mark. A month later, he still has the mark on his back where he was bitten. And he lets me know in this conversation that this little girl is the same little girl. The teacher won't tell us the child's name. They can't tell us the child's name. So we don't know who these people are until he tells us. This is the same little girl who bit him a month ago. So in 3-year-old language, he is telling me, "Daddy, what you need to understand is we got beef. This didn't start today. I didn't just walk up to her and out of nowhere put my hands on her. No, a month ago, I was minding my business and reading my Bible and praying to the Lord. and I got this sharp pain in my back, and I turn around, and here's this little girl with fangs biting me. And so from that day forward, I feel like I need to protect myself. So whenever I see her, before she gets me, I get her. So anyway, he says, she looks like she's thinking about biting me. That's the mind of a three-year-old. So I'm sitting him down, and I'm trying to walk him through this. I say, Doc, we don't do that. We don't do that. Listen to me. We don't do that here. If you feel the need to be protected, now mommy and daddy know what's going on. Your teacher knows what's going on. Mommy and daddy function as your protector. We can let your teacher know what to be on the watch for. If it does not get fixed, then we will address it. But it's not you who are going to go around hitting people. And so I walk him through all of those details. And I'm telling him that he cannot do that. I'm saying, boys, don't hit girls. You will never see daddy put his hands on mommy in a violent manner. Boys, don't hit girls. I tell you all the time, I never want to find out that you have hit your sister. I'm making this very clear to him. Boys, don't hit girls. Then Cherie comes up behind me and she says, Brandon, you have to also tell him that boys don't hit boys. Well, wait a minute. Listen. I mean, she's right. She's right. She's right. But I'm like, you don't hit a girl. If a girl hits you, you tell someone. What I want to say to him is if a boy hits you, then you rearrange the furniture with this dude. That's what I want to, that's what I want to tell him. But my wife's standing there, so I can't say it right in front of her. Can't stand. But what I'm telling him, you don't hit boys either, right? He's like, I got you, daddy. I got you. I got you. I got you, daddy. I'm on it. Like, tuck the chin in. I got it. I got it. All right? When she leaves, I sit him down. And I said, son, today, this was the second day. This was, I went and spoke to the teacher the next day. And I said, when I walked into your teacher's room, she said, Reverend Washington, we need to have a conversation about Ellis hitting this little girl in the class. And I took note of this. Normally, she calls me Dad or I'm Mr. Washington. But on that particular day, I was Reverend Washington. And I said to her, I said to Ellis, I said, I had this conversation with your teacher. And so I need to walk you through this really quickly. I said, boy, your name. And he says, Ellis. I said, Ellis what? He says, Ellis Patrick. I said, boy, you know what I'm doing here. What is your name? He says, my name is Ellis Patrick Washington. I said, exactly. I said, when you leave this house, you represent the Washington household. When you are out in the world and the world looks at you, it is your responsibility to be sure that people say he has a mother and a father at home who are intentionally raising him. Because when you are out in the world, it's not just about you. I don't care if you decide you're gonna mess up Ellis, but when you mess up Washington, now we have a problem. You need to be mindful of this. You were not yours, you were mine. And when you are mine, you go out into the world, you represent the one to whom you belong. And you need to function for just a moment as though it is important to you to be a Washington. Because when you go out in the world, it's not just about you. It's about us. What he's telling you in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 16, he's saying, do you not understand who you are? When you go out into the world, it's not just about you. You are representing someone to whom you belong. And when you put his name on display, the response of the world should be, the person I'm looking at right now is the child of a God who knows and loves him or her. And you should be intentional to carry that name carefully. Paul says, do you not appreciate that you are the temple of the Spirit of God? That is not to be taken lightly. In fact, here's your runway. Here's your setup. We're going to come back to this. Keep your finger here. But turn to Galatians chapter 4. The book of Galatians chapter 4. Verse 4. Galatians chapter 4. And we're going to start at verse 4. For context, let's start at verse 1. It's just better. Let's start at verse 1. Paul also writing this book, letter, he says, I mean that the heir, as long as he is a child, is no different from a slave. Though he is the owner of everything, he is under guardians and managers until the date set by his father. In the same way, we also, when we were children, were enslaved to the elementary principles of the world. But when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his son, born of woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, so that we might receive adoption as sons. And because you are sons, God has sent the spirit of his son into our hearts, crying, Abba, Father. So you are no longer a slave, but a son. And if a son, then an heir through God. This is what he just told you. He's given them the context, the significance of the law. And he's telling them that the entire time we were under the law, we were slaves to the law. The responsibility we had was one of behavior and function. And it was futile because we were unable to perfectly apply that law. And then when the fullness of time had come, I love verse 4, because he lets you know in verse 4 that this was always a part of the plan. The son does not show up arbitrarily. He shows up according to a schedule. When the fullness of time had come, the Son of God comes and dies on your behalf. And because of his death, you have experienced what he says in the passage is adoption. So God moves from being your taskmaster who uses the law as a whip to being your father. And he has given you his name. You are now his sons and his daughters. And when you leave your home, frankly, when you are in your home, then your responsibility is to live in such a manner that displays what it is to look like he is your father. I have a nephew, and his name was Deshaun. And for those of you who do not know, my brother has been in prison since he was 17 years old. And he is 30, how old am I? He is 35 now. He'll be 35 in 2 weeks. So, and he's been in prison since he was 17. We found out that his girlfriend was pregnant right after he was arrested. So his son has never had one-on-one interaction with him outside of a prison setting. When the moment he was born, I remember calling my brother to tell him this. The moment he was born, and I saw him in person, my nephew, and I saw him in person, he looked exactly the way I recall my brother looking at the same age. I'm 4 years older, so I remember when my brother was a newborn. And I remember him looking exactly the same. In fact, when I got home, I ended up putting photos of both of them at the same age next to one another. And I was astounded at how much they looked alike. And I made that very clear. I said to my brother, I said, man, you cannot waste our time trying to deny this one. This one's yours. He looks just like you. And every time I would see my nephew, because I missed my brother, I would make it a point to tell him how much he looks like his father. Every time I said, boy, you look just like your daddy. And I would tell him that since he was a small child. And then he went through 2 years old, and I can only imagine what's in the mind of a two-year-old. And then I said to him while he's 3 and 4 and 5, and then about 7 or 8 years old, I find out what's going on in his mind. I said, man, you look just like your daddy. He looked at me and says, Unc, listen, he's my father. Shouldn't I look like him? In the mind of a two-year-old, it doesn't make sense for you to tell me I'm his son. It doesn't make sense for you to tell me that I look just like him. That's a foregone conclusion. We can just write that one off as I know, because since he's my father, I should look like him. That was in the mind of a child. I want for you to have the minds of children. And I want for you to say, it's just a presumption that because he is my father, I am supposed to look like him. Now, if you look back at chapter 3 of 1 Corinthians, he gives you some background here that we read really quickly. In fact, turn to chapter 1 and look at how he introduces it. He says in chapter 1, verse 1, Paul, called by the will of God to be an apostle of Christ Jesus, and our brother Sosthenes, to whom is he writing? To the church of God that is in Corinth, to those sanctified in Christ Jesus, called to be saints together with all those who are in every place called upon the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, both their Lord and ours. Notice how he identifies them. He's not writing the letter to a general group of people. He's writing it to a very specific group of people, and he refers to them as those who have identified Christ as their Lord and identified themselves according to who he is, and he even uses the word sanctified. He's saying that they have experienced the sanctification that comes along with having Christ as your Redeemer. In other words, the people who are reading the letter, the people to whom he has addressed the letter, are believers. And he's saying to believers that you are supposed to have a life that makes your relationship with Christ evident. Now, we touched on this last week in some detail, but he's not done talking about it when we get to verse 16. He's saying you are to live a life that lets everyone know that you have already experienced sanctification. You're not moving toward it. You already have it. And you're supposed to live as though you already have it. Don't wear the uniform and not play the game. He's saying if you are his, then it should be evident to everyone who sees you that you are his. And then he realizes that their behavior is inconsistent with such an expectation of them. In fact, when we walk through this book, the thing you're going to notice is that he has consistent frustration and confusion. He's like, why do you live this way? If you are on high, then why do you relish that which is down low? If you are his, then why do you struggle so much with rejoicing over being his? And then he gets to chapter 3, verse 16, and he makes an observation that jumped out at me. He's telling them, you don't realize who you are in him. He says to them explicitly in chapter 3, verse 16, do you not know that you are God's temple? And that God's spirit dwells in you. Now, I don't know why we do this. I don't know why we do this. But we have this habit. And it's probably because of chapter and verse divisions. But we tend to read past things really quickly. And we don't allow for the moment for it to land on us and appreciate the weight of what was just said. He just said to you in verse 16, that there is still a temple of God. In other words, there's a place where God abides. There's a place where God tabernacles. This is where the Spirit of God lives. And then he identifies you as that place. If ever you're finding yourself wondering, do I have value? Do I have meaning? Is the world impacted by my very presence? Then you should step back in the midst of that struggle, in the midst of asking yourself those questions, and you should ask yourself, how useless can I be if the God who hovered over nothing and turned it into something, if that God has decided that I'm going to be the place where he resides? You are the temple of God. And by virtue of that, you have value. You have the highest value. You are the pinnacle of God's creation. Everything else is extra. We are the main course. Everything else is decoration that exists for our sake. It exists for our benefit. The air and water and mountains and sun and stars that we either adore or worship, that stuff is just there as ornamentation around the crown jewel of his creation. And the crown jewel is you. He did not decide to indwell and treat mountains as the temple of God. He decided that he's going to call each and every person in this room by name and said, I intend to abide in you. And my only request is that you live as though I am present. Now, here's the rejoicing part of that. And here's the terrifying part of that. Because there's both. You can rejoice because there is never a moment when you are without God. You can rejoice because there's never a moment when God is not around. For that, you can rejoice. Now, here's the terror of that. You can be terrified because there is never a moment when God is not around. It's a double-edged sword. He is your greatest joy, and he is also the greatest convictor. In fact, Paul says in the book of Ephesians that because of his presence within us, our actions can grieve him. The intentional, the appropriate, the literal translation of the word used there for grieve is molest. Because he is within us, when we engage in things that dishonor him, we bring him along with us to execute the dishonoring act. And that is an act of violation against him. Not violation in that you transgressed a line, but violation in that you made him be present as you transgressed the line. Do you not know that you are the temple of the Spirit of God? And then he identifies some of the significance of that. Look at what he says in verse 17. He says, if anyone destroys God's temple, God will destroy him. For God's temple is holy, and you are that temple. So anything that you do against yourself is an assault against the temple of God, which is made holy by the very presence of God. Now you're thinking, what are the implications of this? What are the consequences of this? How is it that it's necessary for him to go into this detail with us and the church at Corinth? Now, we're going to unfold this when we get to chapter 4, because when he gets to chapter 4, he's going to start addressing some of the specific means by which they were violating the temple that is their person. I'm not merely referring to your body. I'm talking about your actual person. And they were violating their person where the Spirit of God abides. He's going to go into some of the details of that. There was a man in an affair with his stepmother, and there were lawsuits against one another, and they were abusing the communion table, and they were abusing spiritual gifts, and they were asking for permission to have sex with prostitutes as an act of worship with both men and women, and they had all these things going on. And he says to them, as the temple of God, you're bringing God into those experiences, and you are violating him, you are molesting him, you are grieving him by having him be present for those things. But you're thinking, we don't do any of that stuff, so what is it that we do that drags him into these experiences? I don't want to be the broken record on this thing, but if it is true that you are the Spirit of God, and by bringing yourself into a sinful scenario, you are also bringing him into it, then we now have to abandon the idea that there are victimless sins. Are you tracking with that? No such thing. In fact, the way we address this is, okay, Brandon, Eve, this is my body. I can do with and in my body whatever I want. God does not have to be a part of this. And this is me. Even if I'm wrong, I'm not making him do it with me. But he just tells you in verse 16 that you are the temple. So when you engage in whatever self-destructive, sinful, rebellious thing, whatever thing that shames him, whatever thing that embarrasses his name as your father, and you brought him along with him, you have not only sinned in and of yourself, but your sin is directly against him. And I don't mean it's against the line of his holiness. That's true as well. I mean, you have actually made him sit and be present and abide with you while you do it against him. Guys, I've been a pastor in some regard or another for about 16 years now, and I realize now that I was pastoring in a bubble, because in Texas, while trust me, it is not true that everyone there is a Christian, they have been culturally Christianized. So here's how it works for us in Texas, okay? Dudes would go out the night before and they would do dirt, or they would go out and they would go to a party, or they would be they would go to a club and pick up whomever they will and then go home with whomever they will and do whatever they will, and they would get home just in time for their grandmother to make them go to church. And because they were having to go to church on a Sunday basis, on a regular basis, with their grandmother, while they were doing dirt all week, they knew that which pleased or displeased God. And so the life they lived was not a matter of whether or not they knew what was offensive or undermining or assaulting against God. It was whether or not they cared. Well, here's how that works for me. Because they knew the rules, and that's what I use that word intentionally, they're not actually rules, they're relationship, but because they knew what they identified as rules, when I sit down with them, they would speak the right language. And so I said, guys, listen, I hear you with this whole thing about, you know, I need to test drive the car before I get married. I know about that. I hear that. I already hear that. I already know that story. And you're thinking, I don't want to marry someone unless I have, unless I've had this opportunity to see what kind of person they are in their home life. And I need to know what kind of things I can expect from them. And so we're gonna live together for a while. And by a while, I mean, I don't know, 8-9 years. And then after those 8 years are up, then we'll see if this marriage thing is a good idea. And so I sit down with them and I walk them through some of the shortcomings of that. First of all, when you are in a pseudo marriage, when you're living with a person, you're not actually seeing that person. You are engaging their representative. If you don't believe that, ask a married person. My wife knew me for 4 years. No, we did not live together. My wife knew me for 4 years before we got married. She found out stuff about me in the first month of my marriage that she was shocked by, because she'd known me for 4 years. I have very specific idiosyncrasies when it comes to cleaning things up. So there are parts of the house that I want to be immaculate, and there are other parts like, I don't really care. And so you can tell where those spots are, because when I get home, it's wherever the pile of clothes were. It's where I stopped moving to change clothes, and that's where everything is. And that drives her crazy. And then she has things about her that drive me crazy. She's not here, so I can say it. So my wife does not turn off lights. Drives me crazy. Especially now that I pay the light bill. Drives me crazy. Especially at about 6 o'clock in the morning when she gets up. She's a morning person. Who whistles when they wake up? Who does that? She wakes up all like, just good morning, Jesus, and just whistling and just singing songs and turning on lights and opening curtains. And I'm like, baby, it is 6:30 in the morning. I don't even think Jesus is up yet. And so, like, what are you doing? This is just, you never told me this was you before we got married. Before, when she's going to take a shower, I don't know why she does this. When she's going to take a shower, she turns the shower on and then she'll go do something. She has to make sure the water's hot, okay? But she makes sure the water's hot for like 14 minutes. You open the door and it's like a gust of steam. My pores just open up. It's just like this moment where it's just humid in the room. Like, Sheree, you know the shower's running? Yeah, I know. You didn't forget? No, I'm on my way. That drives me crazy. I sat down with all of our friends who knew her when we were growing up. I said, guys, some of you were her roommates before we got married. Why didn't y'all tell me about this shower thing? Because here's what you need to know. Some stuff you don't learn until you're actually doing it. And marriage is one of those things. It is an absolute waste of your time to try to figure out who a person is as a spouse by entering into a pseudo-marriage. It is an absolute waste of your time. I'm giving you the sociological argument against that. Okay? You tracking with that? You hear me? You got it? Good. Forget the sociology. It's sin. Just sin. And you're thinking, no, it's not, Brandon. We don't sleep in the same bed. Listen, I was born at night. It was not last night, okay? So don't tell me that ever again. Everyone in the room who has ever told me that, stop telling me that, okay? I was engaged before, and God was smart enough to put 1,000 miles between me and the woman to whom I was engaged. You know why? Because I know how biology works. I know how it works. And I know that the closer you get to the actual day when you can do stuff, the more difficult it will be to keep from doing stuff. So stop telling me that. Stop telling me that you can't easily walk upstairs to address this thing that's going on within you. Stop telling me that. It's sin because you're tempting yourself and you're succumbing to the sin. But those of you who are able to convince me that you're not, here's what you need to understand. Even if you're not doing it, you need to be mindful about the very appearance of sin. So your neighbors, who were also not born last night, and see you living there together, they're saying, there's no way in the world this is happening, and they're not engaging in some inappropriate thing by their standard, not by ours. So you're telling us you love Jesus, but you're doing this thing that is inconsistent with the Jesus that you tell us that you love. That's the thing I'm pushing back on. That's the thing we're talking about. That's the thing that everyone's telling me about. Everyone's saying, this is who we are. We're living together, but we're just doing this for financial reasons, and they're telling me that we have to do this, and God's okay with it. And if we do slip up, he's not even present for that anyway. And I'm telling you that when you slip up, he's present. And it is an assault against both his holiness and his person. It's not just Corinth. It is us. There is no such thing as the victimless sin. David's walking around on the roof of his castle when he was supposed to be on the front lines with the army. While he's up there, he sees Bathsheba taking a bath in plain sight of the king. Now, we can have a conversation about whether or not that was intentional. I think it was. I think she knew what she was doing. I think she knew what time of her, what part, I've said this to you before. I think she knew where she was in her womanly process, and so her pregnancy did not catch her off guard. I think she knew exactly what she was doing. He calls her, and they engage in sexual intimacy, and they conceive a child. Nathan confronts him, and the response that David has as a result of being called out by Nathan is, against you, O Lord, and you alone have I sinned. But wait a minute. It was a sexual act with a woman. How was God involved? Because David is the temple of the Spirit of God. And when he went into that act of rebellion and adultery with this woman, he not only violated God's holiness, he violated God's person. Are you with me? You need to be mindful of who you are and whose you are. And if you're mindful of who you are and whose you are, then you will realize that when you violate the standard that he's laid out before you, in which he says, when you leave this house, you bear my name and you put my name on display in a manner that glorifies me, then your response to that will be, when I sin, I'm not sinning in a vacuum. I'm violating his holiness and his person. And he says to the person in verse 17 that there are consequences for such an act. Look at what he says explicitly in verse 17. He says, if anyone destroys God's temple, God will destroy him. For God's temple is holy and you are the temple. So keep in mind, he's not changing the subject. And remember how he applied the word temple. When he used the word temple in verses 16 and 17, he's talking about your person. He's not talking about a building. He's talking about you, because you're the place where God abides. And he's only talking to believers. So in a letter written to Christians who have experienced sanctification, and that's the only reason they're able to be the temple and be the place where the Spirit of God abides, he says, if you violate the temple, speaking of your person, then God will have consequences. He will be the destroyer of you. Now, does that mean that you have a loss of salvation? No. Does it mean that you have a loss of relationship? No. But it does mean that the fellowship between you and the God who indwells you will be hindered. So the best illustration I have for this is marriage, okay? So I've been married for 10 years. In December, it'll be 10 and a half years. And I know that this may shock many of you, but in 10 years, I still have not mastered marriage, which is okay. Because on the day of my wedding, I said that I'm going to be married to her until death do us part. And my guess is it's going to take me about that long to get this thing right. Okay? And because of that, I will still do things that violate things that bring her joy. I will still have moments where I will mess stuff up. I will still have the stumbling block moments, which will result in these occasional tiffs between us. Not fights. These are tiffs. They look like fights because they're fights. But I don't like calling them that. We don't do it in front of the kids. It's a closed door thing, and no one's yelling, but we're whispering really hard. We have those moments. We have those moments. Occasionally. They don't happen often. They happen occasionally. The good thing about them is the redeemable part of it is oftentimes they will happen on a Monday and a Thursday. I don't know why. They'll happen on a Monday and a Thursday, which means that on in the midst of that, whenever it happens, on the rare occasion it happens very, very rarely, I end up being on the couch, not sleeping there, but just sitting there thinking, okay, when I go upstairs, this is how I'm apologize when I go upstairs. Like, baby, I would. No, that's too hard. How am I going to initiate this reconciliation? How am I going to do that? You know what? I need something to distract me. It's Monday. Let's watch some football. And while I'm watching football, I'm thinking, oh, wait a minute. Now I've added something else to the list of things for which I need to apologize, because while I'm down here watching football, I'm supposed to be upstairs apologizing. And in her mind, I'm prioritizing football over the apology that I'm supposed to be giving to her. All that stuff's going on in her head, which speaks to how much I have not mastered this thing. So I turn it off and I go upstairs and we have this restoration. But keep this in mind, the entire time I was downstairs and she was upstairs, we were at odds. Okay? Now let me ask you a question. When I was downstairs and she was upstairs, was she still my wife? Yes, she was. The relationship was still intact. The relationship was still in place. You know what was gone? Fellowship. We had no fellowship. In fact, my wife, when those moments happen, she gets very professional. I walk in, baby, yes, what can I do for you? Like, I need to get an appointment so we can reconcile. Broken fellowship in the midst of maintained relationship. When he tells you that you will experience destruction, he's not telling you that he's going to end the paternal relationship with you. The God that we worship is faithful, and sometimes he loves us because of us, and sometimes he loves us in spite of us. And he's going to maintain that affection for us. He's going to be the preserver of the relationship. But let me tell you something. When you drag him into sin and you violate both his holiness and his person, you need to rest assured that in that moment, there's a brokenness of fellowship. And let me tell you something. The worst thing in the world is to have a person who you love this much say to you, you and I need to be restored in our fellowship. Until then, all of the benefits of having me are shut off. And that to you, especially when it's God, will have the weight of destruction. He's telling you, I will remove the fellowship if you continue to rebel and sin against me. I have given you the privilege of having me. Don't abuse the privilege. Don't abuse my presence. Don't forget who you are and whose you are. Now, I'm going to tell you this. That's not the big idea of the passage. It's not. Because remember, what he's doing here is addressing, in chapter 3, divisions within the according to who the teachers were. And then he stops in the middle of it to tell them about how working provides an eternal reward. And then he gets to verse 16 and tells them that you are the Spirit of God in whom he has indwelled. And there is a privilege to that because you are now made the holy temple because the Spirit of God has indwelled you. And then he goes back into the divisions conversation starting at verse 18. This is a sidebar. He decided to stop in the midst of it and build upon it. It's a tangential moment. He says, by the way, since I'm talking about this, let me also mention to you that you have forgotten who you are. I don't understand how you live the lives that you live. These divisive lives where you're choosing this person over this person when Jesus is the God of both. He says, have you forgotten that you are the temple? And because of that, you have value and you are made holy. And he's saying to them, don't set the holiness aside so that you can have your earthly display of what holiness looks like. He's calling us to something higher. He's calling us to something higher. He does not want for you to go to church. He wants for you to be the church. There is a difference. He does not want for you to know things about him. He wants for you to know him. Now, you're thinking, I have to know things about him so that I may know him. I agree with that. I agree. You cannot know him without knowing things about him. But the reverse is not true. It is impossible to sit back and say, I'm going to pursue him to the details, the specifics regarding who he is. That's not what he wants from you. He wants for you to say, I know him, and as evidence of that, you can look at who I am and see the life that I display, and I look just like my daddy. In fact, the passage that we read in Galatians chapter 4, in which Paul says that you have been adopted as sons, and now you see God as Abba Father, that is an affectionate term for him, and it means Papa. It means he's your dad. He's not the king sitting on a throne entirely removed from us. He's the father who knows you by name and who wants for you to know him by name. He wants for you to see him as dad. But he also wants you to live as though he is dad. Now we got to go. We got to go. We got to stop because I have kept you long 2 weeks in a row. And so I'm going to try to stop talking so I can try to start gradually making up for the 10 minutes per week that I stole from you over the past 2 weeks. I owe you 20 minutes, and so I'm going to give you those 20 minutes back over the course of the next 6 months. Okay, so so I'm going to try to get you out of here a minute early. But here's what I want you to hear me say. When I tell you that we're in a season where we have to have conversations about what it means for us to grow up, I'm not telling you that you need to become something. That's not what I'm telling you. What I am telling you is you are something. And the thing I'm calling you to is act as though you are the thing that you are. It's not a process by which you work toward adulthood. I'm telling you that if you are in this room, you've already experienced sanctification. So don't think you have to work toward the sanctification goal. Instead, what you should be thinking is, I am sanctified. So I should live as though I am sanctified. I should make it a point to look at my life and say, how consistent is the life I'm living reflecting the office and position and elevation I hold? If he has indwelled me, do I have outcome? Do I have fruit? Are there results of him being my indweller? If he has sanctified me and given me insight into things that are on high, do I now live as though I have access and appreciation of the things that are on high? Or are we like children, wanting the benefits of adulthood while simultaneously wanting the benefits of childhood? I want the blessings of freedom in adulthood, but I want for someone to take care of me and give me constant passes as though I am a child. So I take Ellis to school 2 days after our hitting incident. And we have a sit down with the teacher, and one of the things that he must do is apologize to Miss B for having disrupted her class by smacking some of his classmates around. And I don't want, I'm glad he told me, but I don't want for him to use the fact that this little girl who bit him a month, that she bit him a month ago, I don't want for him to use it as an excuse. So in the midst of the apology, I don't want for him to say, "I'm sorry I hit her, but," okay? I don't want that. You already told me that was going on. We're addressing that. Just come and sit down with her and give her the apology. Now, here's how the classrooms work. There are three teachers in the classroom. There's two active teachers at Hope Center. They have what they call grandmothers in every class. They're actual grandmothers. They're old enough to be Ellis's. Some of them are old enough to be his great-grandmother. And the thing you need to know about Ellis is he is both he's both cute and aware. He's cute and he knows it. And he has learned, especially around adult ladies, to use that to his benefit. So when he's sitting down with them and he's starting the apology, he does this thing. And I saw it happen. I saw it happen. He starts the apology. He says, I apologize for, and then he does it. He tilts his head. And they didn't let him finish. Oh, man, we know. She probably had it coming. You should have. That's what happened. Especially the grandmother. She responded to him immediately. He didn't even get a chance to finish it. And my response was like, "Wait a minute, stop. Let me parent the boy. He did something he should not have done. Do not, in this moment, give him the benefit of being three. But he's only three. I don't care. I don't care. For the moment, let's not give him the benefit of being three. He has to see this thing to the end. Let him finish. Let him finish. Hug him when he's done. Please. Let him finish this. Now, go." And now he's all confused. He's like, "Daddy, you're making me apologize to people who don't even want it." I said, "Boy, I'm about to hit you." So we have this thing like where I had to stop and explain to him again because they kind of ruined this thing I had planned out, had it laid out for them, and it's planned, and they messed the whole thing up. So I had to say, "Okay, you guys go sit over there." And I say, "Son, this is how we rehearse this at home, and you're going to see this to the end, because if not, then this whole thing would have been for naught, and you would not have the lesson that you're supposed to learn here." So he's like, "Okay, I got it. And he goes to them, and then he does the head tilt a thing again because he can't help it. And then they know that I don't want them to respond to it. They let him finish. And then they're even more exuberant with their affection for him, and they pick him up, and he's just looking at me like, "Yeah, Daddy." And this they're having this hug moment, and all the things happening in the midst of this. And I'm saying to them, "Guys, listen, if you, as a matter of course, let it be okay that he can rebel against you, he can take over the class by striking the other students in the room, and then all he has to do is give you a half-hearted, smile, charismatic, cute, three-year-old apology, and you will dismiss it right away, then you're doing a disservice to him, because one day when he's 30 years old, he's going to think he can still do that. I'm not talking to you as a guy. I'm talking to you as the man who is responsible for being sure that this boy turns into a man. And I'm not going to be having this boy living in my house at 30 years old because you let him tilt his head and convince you that this is all he needs to give you. He has to grow up." And their response to me was, "But you're making him act older than he is." And I said, "That's how it works. You have him stretch out beyond where he is." I'm going somewhere with this. "You have him stretch out beyond where he is so that he never stays where he is." Everyone in the room is saying, "Brandon, you're asking me to make life adjustments that are beyond where I am right now." And I said, "Exactly. I'm telling you that you're supposed to stretch yourself sacrificially, beyond where you currently are. He's saying, but that's going to be a stress. That's going to be difficult for me. That's going to be sacrificial for me. You mean to tell me that you're going to have struggles sacrificing a life of sin in the face of the God who died so that you could have him? I'm telling you that he's calling you up to being sacrificial and stretching yourself beyond your comfort zone. Because if you do not do that, then you will remain where you are. And it is time for you to grow up. And I'm not going to let you smile and cock your head to the side with this coy, charismatic, cute little 3-year-old boy thing. Stop trying to play me. It's time for us to grow up. And so when you're saying to me, but Brandon, we love him so much. We love Jesus. Hell, he's ours. And he's our greatest joy. He's our greatest joy. But he better stay out of this part of our lives. I'm sitting here saying to you, he is the God of that part of your life. And you just told him to step out of it. So it's time for you to stretch. Because if you don't, then you'll stay here. And staying here is sinning against his person and his holiness. And for that, you may experience the separation of his fellowship, and you don't want that. Let's pray. Lord, we bless you for who you are. And we ask that you would remind us that when we are living lives that please us first, we're not doing so in a vacuum. When we do that, we are also living a life that displeases, offends, undermines, rejects, it diminishes you. So show us what it is to be deeply in love with you so that it is not an act of duty, not an act of law. This is not a list of rules. But we say, I rejoice over having the God of the world treat me as his temple. How can I live a life that reflects the fact that I am the temple of the living God? Worship him like that. Live for him like that. Adore him like that. You don't do it because you have to. You do it because you get to. It's in the name of your son, Jesus Christ, we pray. And all God's people said, amen. Amen.